These last few weeks, we've been looking at the Gospel of Mark. Specifically, we've been starting at the middle of the Gospel, sort of with the climax or the crux of Jesus' earthly ministry prior to his crucifixion and resurrection from the grave, the point at which he shifted his ministry to disciples. We started looking at the story of a man who was blind and how Jesus healed him. And it's a very unusual healing story because it happened in stages. Like, Jesus came and he healed the guy, and the guy went from no sight to sort of partial sight. Like me, he could see fuzzy outlines, sort of like an impressionist painter, but he couldn't see clearly. And then Jesus touched him again, and he went from partial vision to full clarity. And we talked about how that sort of parallels the spiritual journey of the disciples, that they began not having any perception of Jesus at all, being as though blind in the dark. And then they began to dimly perceive the outlines of what he was all about. And then finally, with a touch of Jesus, they're going to come ultimately to full clarity on him. The next week, we looked at the follow-up story to that, when Jesus is walking along with the disciples, and he says, "Who do people say that I am?" And they're like, "Well, some say you're John the Baptist, some say you're Elijah. A lot of people think you're a prophet of some sort." And then the key question comes, "Who do you say that I am?" And Peter's like, "Well, you're the Messiah." And Jesus said, "Zip it! Quiet! Don't tell anybody that!" And that was very perplexing to a lot of people. But the reason Jesus did it is because the only thing worse than having no information about Jesus is having false information about Jesus. And Peter had a very misleading notion of what the Messiah was all about. I called it the Chuck Norris Messiah. Chow Yun-Fat, the Spider-Man, Batman, put a beat down on the Romans Messiah. The one who would come and rule Rome with an iron rod from Jerusalem. And that's not what Jesus was about at all. And the question that we pose ourselves then is, which Jesus are you following? Who do you say that I am? And are you willing to follow the Jesus that is presented in the Bible, the Jesus as he is, or the Jesus of your dreams, the Jesus that you wish the Bible had presented? And this week, we follow right on the heels of that, starting in Mark chapter 9, verse 2. After 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him and led them up a high mountain where they were all alone. So he left the other 9 disciples behind and took these 3. There he was transfigured before them. His clothes became dazzling white, whiter than anyone in the world could bleach them. And there appeared before them Elijah and Moses, who were talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up 3 shelters, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah." He did not know what to say. They were so frightened. All right, there's a lot happening in this story. And actually, the most pivotal thing is just covered so quickly in one sentence that you almost miss it. First, something that strikes me. Mark is written in non-chronological order. Most of the Gospels. In fact, all the Gospels save Luke are written in non-chronological order. They were thematically arranged by the author. And Mark is no different. So whenever he mentions the passage of time in a specific way, so for example, Jesus lay in the grave three days, or when he says after 6 days, that's significant. He's trying to draw our attention to something special about that time frame. So, 6 days. What in the world could be significant about 6 days? Can you think of anything in the Bible that took 6 days to do? The creation in Genesis. And what happened on the sixth day? God created us. God revealed himself in a new way through people. He made us in his image. And at that point, the whole universe was able to see God more perfectly and clearly than they had before. That's the foreshadowing that we've got here going into this story. And so they get up all alone on the top of this mountain, and Jesus transforms. The Greek word there is the word we get metamorphosis from. He undergoes some sort of radical transformation. Sort of like after he raises from the grave, if you remember later on in the story, I hope I'm not giving anything away here. Later on, he dies and comes back. If you haven't heard that yet, you should read it. Didn't mean to spoil the ending for you. At the end, when Jesus is raised from the dead, people don't recognize him at first. He's been transformed in some way. Same thing happens here. And the transformation is so thoroughgoing that all that the witness whose testimony lies behind this account can say, probably Peter, is clothes. They were so white. They were whiter than I even have words to describe. And Jesus himself was just transformed. He was different. And there appeared with him 2 people, Elijah and Moses. Why these 2? Well, Elijah was the greatest of the prophets. He was the one who stood down the hundreds of prophets of Baal in Israel's darkest day. And Moses is the one who brought down the law from Mount Sinai. He is the lawgiver. The law and the prophets, The exemplars of both of these traditions in the Judaic faith stand before Jesus and converse with him as an equal. Well, what's going through Peter's mind? Wow, he is the Messiah. He is the third age of Judaism. He is the one. We need to, okay, first, Elijah and Moses, you're not going anywhere. We've been missing you guys for a while. You're staying, and we're putting up some tents. This is going to be awesome. And Jesus goes on. Then a cloud appeared and enveloped them, and a voice came from the cloud. This is my son, whom I love. Listen to him. Only the second time in the Gospel of Mark that God speaks from the heavens. The first time was at the baptism of Jesus. You are my son, whom I love. With you I am well pleased. He spoke to Jesus. Now he speaks not to Jesus, but to the crowd around Jesus, to the three disciples specifically. And he speaks to them, this is my son. Not merely the Messiah that you think. This is my son. Listen to him. That's a very strange instruction. I mean, these are the three people who are most committed to Jesus and his teaching. Like when Jesus has to single out just three to be in on something super secret and ultra important, he picks these three, Peter, James, and John. But God says, listen to him. Why? Because you're not hearing what he's saying. This is my son, and you need to pay attention to what he tells you because you're missing something very profound. And suddenly they looked around, and they no longer saw anyone with them except Jesus. In the presence of Jesus, Elijah and Moses, as important and as vital as though they are to the foundations of the faith, fade away. They evaporate into the background, and only Jesus is left. See, Peter, James, and John had it wrong. Jesus did not converse with them as their equal, but as their superior, as something completely new and completely different, as God's fullest revelation to man on the sixth day. The story goes on. As they were coming down from the mountain, so these same four people, Jesus, Peter, James, and John, go down the mountain. Jesus gives them orders not to tell anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. The Son of Man is Jesus' favorite title for himself. And this is the first time that his injunctions to silence have had a condition on them. Almost always, in fact, always to this point, he's just said, zip it, don't tell anyone. Like the Chuck Norris Messiah thing, Peter, no. Now he says, comma, until. Why? Because there is no possible way that people will be able to understand all these details and how they fit together until the end of the story. It would be like watching The Sixth Sense without seeing the last scene. You wouldn't have a way to, you would have a total misguided perception of what the whole thing was about. And so Jesus says, now someday you need to tell people about this, but not yet. We're still getting things set up. We're orchestrating things. There's a plan at work. And so they kept the matter to themselves, discussing what rising from the dead meant. They're very confused about that. And so they ask him, why do the teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first? Now to us, that sounds like a non sequitur. Like they're wondering, you know, what does rising from the dead mean? So why do the teachers say Elijah must come first? Very perplexing to them. Jesus replied, to be sure, Elijah does come first and restores all things. Why then is it written that the Son of Man must suffer first and be rejected? In other words, he takes their question as making sense and replies to it sensibly. What they're getting at, there's this teaching in Judaism that Elijah is going to come first. It's sort of like they had a Chuck Norris Messiah notion of who Jesus was going to be. He was going to beat down the Romans. Elijah, too, was going to come and perform a certain role, and his role was going to be to make the way ready for the Messiah. Among other things in their mind, sort of preparing the ground at home so that then the Messiah could go and do vengeance abroad. And so there was going to be no one to harm the Messiah. So if Elijah is going to come first and take care of this problem, how is it that the Son of Man has to suffer? This makes no sense to us. Jesus explains, I tell you, Elijah has come. And they did everything to him that they wished, just as it is written about him. In other words, just as deeply as you misunderstood the nature of the Messiah, you thought he would be, you misunderstood Elijah. And in other parallel gospel accounts, it explains that this is John the Baptist that he's speaking about, who came in the role of Elijah to prepare. Now, they still don't get it. They don't want to get it. They want their Jesus to be a certain way. They're unwilling to accept him on his own terms. And here we come now to one of my all-time favorite stories in the Bible. Possibly my favorite, it's really hard to say, but certainly on my short list. In verse 14, so these four come down the mountain. When they come to the other disciples, they saw a large crowd around them and the teachers of the law arguing with them. As soon as all the people saw Jesus, they were overwhelmed with wonder and ran to greet him. What are you arguing with them about? He asked. A man in the crowd answered, Teacher, I brought you my son. He is possessed by a spirit that has robbed him of speech. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him to the ground. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. I asked your disciples to drive out the spirit, but they could not. Very, very interesting predicament the disciples find themselves in. They were trying to do the work of Jesus without the presence of Jesus. Now, I have to confess to you, I found myself in that situation many times as a minister, that I'm seeking to do things for God, but on my own, in my own way, according to my own plan. Now, right now, most of you are thinking, Glenn, sucks to be you. I'm glad I'm not a minister, so I don't have to worry about that at least. What gave you the idea that you're not a minister? Where did you ever read that in here? You did not. You realize, I hope, that the word minister simply means servant. If you're a servant of Christ, you are a minister of Christ. In fact, in the book of Ephesians, it tells me as a vocational minister, one who, this is my full-time job, that my challenge is to equip you guys to do the work of the ministry here at Stanford, that the ministry relies upon your shoulders. Well, what is my ministry? What does it mean for me to be a minister as a student? Or when I graduate as an engineer, as an architect, as a painter, as a poet, as a fill in the blank? Well, two things. First, of course, it refers to the things that people have done here tonight. Kyle serving as our announcer, that was an act of ministry. Esther leading worship, that was an act of ministry. Desiree setting up the lights, act of ministry. I value those things, Rhea helping to set up. I really appreciate all of you who have served in one capacity or another. That matters, but it really almost pales to insignificance in comparison to the main ministry that you have here at Stanford that is incumbent upon each of you. You are to be ambassadors for the kingdom wherever you go. For the rest of your life, the primary way that you will glorify God with your life will not be in a worship service, whether you're leading it or participating in it from the congregation. It will not be what you do inside the four walls of a church, what you do while listening to a worship CD on the Stairmaster, whatever you know your little environment groove is. That's not going to be it. The main way you worship God with your life will be the way you spend most of your time. Now as a student, someday as a professional in whatever capacity. And if you cannot find a way to convert that experience into an act of worship, you will be very frustrated in your relationship with God. I preached a sermon actually specifically about this last year called Subdue the Earth. I don't have time to get into it right now, but I encourage you, if this is something that really is intriguing to you, go listen to it. It explains a lot that I think too many Christians don't hear. But even in that, there's an added level of challenge. Let's say you're in your lab. Maybe you're doing great at your research. You're solving problems. You're getting publications. Things are coming your way. What are you accomplishing in that lab that an equally talented atheist could not accomplish in your place? You're in the dorm. Things are going well. What are you accomplishing in the dorm for Christ that an equally talented atheist could not achieve in your place? If the answer is nothing, then perhaps, just perhaps, you're in the same situation I found myself in many times and the disciples found themselves in here. They sought to do the work of Jesus without the presence or the power of Jesus. We need to find ways to invite Jesus to be part of our everyday life here at Stanford, if our relationship with him means anything at all. The story goes on. O unbelieving generation, Jesus replied, how long will I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy to me. So they brought him. When the spirit saw Jesus, it immediately threw the boy into a convulsion. He fell to the ground and rolled around, foaming at the mouth. This is pretty vivid imagery here. Jesus asked the boy's father, how long has he been like this? From childhood, he answered. It has often thrown him into fire or water to kill him. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us. If you can, Jesus answered, everything is possible for him who believes. Immediately, the boy's father exclaimed. He cried out, I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief. That sentence right there is why I love this story so much. In fact, I find it to be one of the most frequent prayers that I pray in my life. I've mentioned this before, I'll mention it again. Biblical meditation is not about emptying yourself as you might find in Eastern meditation, where you try to still all your thoughts and achieve absolute tranquility and sort of, just nothingness. That's not biblical meditation. Biblical meditation is filling yourself with God's truth and running it through your mind over and over and over again until, like a river, it erodes the hard, rocky soil of your brain and leaves channels for God's truth to flow through in the future. And this is one phrase that for me has been very instrumental in that. When I pray, I very often find myself praying phrases from the Bible. Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me, a sinner. And this one, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. Perhaps that phrase will resonate with you. If so, I encourage you to make it part of your prayer life. And to me, what I find is as I run phrases like that through my mind over and over and over again, as I think about the story and the person who said it and why he said it, I achieve ever-approaching levels of clarity, asymptotically approaching the real meaning of the story. I get closer and closer. And as I've reflected on this, a couple of things have occurred to me. This guy, this father, had significant barriers to his faith. The first barrier he had to his faith was his circumstances. I mean, seriously, from the time that his son was a little boy, he had seen the power of Satan reign supreme in his life, with no evidence that God was greater, no evidence that God cared. He just saw his son's life torn apart. His circumstances were a significant barrier to his faith. His experience of life did not lend itself easily to believing that God was greater or that God even cared. Another barrier that he had to his faith, Jesus' followers had let him down. He came to them and said, help my son. And instead, trying to do God's work without God's power, they got into a doctrinal argument with other religious leaders. And they achieved zero in the way of compassion or help. He was hurt, in a sense, by Jesus' followers. And that was a barrier to his faith. And the third significant obstacle that stood in his way was uncertainty about Jesus himself. If you can, do something. Jesus, I don't even know if you can. In our day, I don't even know if you're real, if you're out there, if you're listening, if you care, if you can. I need help. And this is the thing that stands out to me. He had just enough faith to say, I believe, help my unbelief. I'm not willing to give it all over yet, but I'm willing to be made willing. I have questions that I don't know how to even get answers for. I've thought about stuff. I don't know. But I am confident enough to address my question directly to you, to address my request directly to you, and to say, if you're there, if you are who I hope you are, if you can do what I really, really want to believe you can do, help my unbelief. Tonight, whether you're a follower of Jesus or you're just checking him out, maybe for the first time, maybe you've been circling for a while, investigating, checking things out, being thwarted by circumstances, perplexed by Jesus' followers, and uncertain about the man himself. If you can just muster up enough faith tonight to say, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief, Jesus will meet you. He will help you. As I said 2 weeks ago, you need a touch from Jesus to go from no sight to partial sight to perfect clarity. And he will help if you cry out to him. We'll come back to that at the end of our message. Verse 25. When Jesus saw that a crowd was running to the scene, he rebuked the evil spirit. You deaf and mute spirit, he said. I command you, come out of him and never enter him again. Important detail, that last clause, by the way. get out and stay out. The spirit shrieked, convulsed him violently, and came out. The boy looked so much like a corpse that many said, he's dead. Did you notice something? When Jesus entered the scene, things went from okay to bad to worse in short order. Boy's okay. The disciples are there. They can't do anything, but nothing's going wrong. Boy's there. He sees Jesus on the ground, foaming at the mouth. Things went from bad to worse. And then Jesus says, come out. And everyone thinks, Jesus killed him. He's dead. Bad Jesus. Often, when God begins to work, things go in the opposite direction from what we expect. If you've ever seen the story of the 10 plagues in Egypt, if you saw the movie The Prince of Egypt, or if you've read the story in the Bible, you may remember that when Moses first came to Pharaoh and said, let my people go, the slavery got worse. Pharaoh said, oh, they want free? All right, have them make more bricks. Make bricks without straw. He made their task harder and harder until finally freedom came. Here, things go from bad to worse. In my life, I found it to be true as well. Do not be discouraged if when you turn to Jesus, your life goes to hell. Because hell's trying to hold on to you. But Jesus is stronger, and he will pull you out. The spirit shrieked, convulsed violently, and came out. The boy looked so much like a corpse that many said he's dead. But Jesus took him by the hand, lifted him to his feet, and he stood up. After Jesus had gone indoors, his disciples asked him privately, why couldn't we drive it out? They didn't want to do that one in public. Hey, Jesus, I noticed that we failed. Would you care to explain my failure in detail in front of all these visiting people? They went to the room. He replied, this kind can only come out by prayer. It's important just side note here. Did Jesus pray in this entire story? Not that I see. I mean, talking to a demon is not prayer. If in your prayers you talk to demons, stop. You're doing it wrong. I will help you. No, what happened is that Jesus is saying to them, unless your life is a life that is marked by prayer, unless you are sort of, your reservoir is filled up by prayer, you won't have the spiritual juice that you need when you encounter the demonic, when you encounter a great spiritual challenge. If you wait until you're parched to try and get water from the well, you're not going to make it. That's the point. Now, I know it's very challenging here at Stanford, especially as midterms come along, things get busier and busier, life spins out of control, to consistently pray and focus on God's word. I challenge you to do it. You'll be glad you did when a great challenge comes your way. You will then have the reservoir that you need. They left that place and passed through Galilee. Jesus did not want anyone to know where they were because he was teaching his disciples. He said to them, the Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men. They will kill him, and after 3 days he will rise. But they did not understand what he meant, and they were afraid to ask him about it. That's the end of our story. That last sentence strikes me. They did not understand Jesus, but they were afraid. Their fear held them back from going to a new level in their spiritual walk with Jesus. How is your fear holding you back tonight? I should say, is your fear holding you back tonight? Perhaps it's not. Most of us, though, there's at least one area of our lives we hold on to tightly, like an acrobat holding onto a trapeze, scared to let go because we don't think that anyone will be there to catch us when we jump. Jesus is there, and he is ready. Tonight, I'm going to close in prayer. And the way I'm going to do it is very simply, I'm going to ask in just a moment, not just yet, for everyone to bow their head for two reasons. A, to sort of create a solemn moment where you can just focus not on the things that are around you, the lights, the screen, me, and all my glory, but instead to just focus inwardly, to close your eyes and not be distracted and think and create a place of privacy in this public setting. And then second, to create that atmosphere of privacy so that when I ask you to respond, you'll be able to do so freely. And what I'm going to do is pray a couple of categories of prayer. If when I come to a certain category, it resonates with you, to the extent that you say, yes, I want you to pray that for me, and I mean it from my heart. Just meet my eye, and I'll know to pray that for you. And I'll email you tomorrow and see if you want to talk about what that meant to you and how I can help you in that process. But it'll be private, you, me, and God.